Publicly available satellite images offer some of the most fascinating perspectives about life on Earth. Today's guest goes one step further and mines those images for the data and stories they contain about some of the world's most repressive regimes. He's Luis Martinez this week on Story in the Public Square. Welcome to Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. I'm Jim Lutis from the Pell Center at Salve Regina University. Alongside me is my friend and co-host, G. Wayne Miller of the Providence Journal. Story in the Public Square is an effort to study, celebrate, and tell stories that matter. We do that by visiting each week with the best contemporary storytellers, authors, scholars, filmmakers, and journalists, really anyone using or studying narrative in all its forms to explain the world in which we live. This week, we're joined by Dr. Luis Martinez, a political economist at the Harris School of Public Policy at the University of Chicago. Luis, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
So you study political economy and the functioning of democracies, principally in Latin America. Yes. What drew you to this work?
So I would say that there's, on the one hand, there's a practical motivation in the sense that that's where I grew up in Latin America. I'm from Colombia. That's the area that I know more about. And of course, for this type of work, knowing a bit about the historical background and the institutional context is very helpful. At the same time, I would also say that there's probably a bit of an ethical or civic motivation in the sense of we hope that the work that we do as academics can somehow contribute to solve problems and improve people's lives. And if my work can help people in Latin America to some extent, even indirectly, that would be great.
So we mentioned that you're a political economist. Is there a direct link between the functioning of an economy and the health of a democracy?
Between the functioning of the economy and the health of the democracy, that's an interesting question, I would say. There is actually a large academic debate in which various researchers have been arguing whether, for instance, democracy is associated with higher economic growth or not. And you can find both sides of that debate with some people saying, yes, of course it is, and some people saying, well, actually, when you look at countries that have experienced these drastic booms in economic activity, and you can think of, say, I don't know, China during the 1980s. You can also think about what happened in Chile under the Pinochet dictatorship. There's also people that argue, no, you need strong rule and you have to lose a bit the democratic political game
to supercharge the economy.
Exactly.
Interesting.
So which side of that equation do you come down on, or do you not favor one or the other?
I would say that the recent evidence seems to be a bit more aligned with the democracy does cause growth idea. My recent work has departed from that a little bit and has said, well, an important aspect worth taking into account is that when we're talking about economic growth, for the most part, we rely on figures and statistics that are produced by the governments themselves. And so when we're saying, okay, do democracies grow more than autocracies, we have to keep in mind that maybe the metric that we're using, these indicators of growth, they're self-reported and they're, for instance, very prone to manipulation or exaggeration.
So in other words, they may not be correct.
Exactly.
So we discovered your work when the Washington Post published an article about a working paper you produced that asked the question, how much should we trust the dictator's GDP estimates? And it seems like your bottom line is not much. We shouldn't trust much. Talk about that, the paper, and why we shouldn't trust a dictator's figures.
So the starting point for this project is that governments of all kinds, both democracies and autocracies, have an incentive to exaggerate just how well the economy is doing. Democratically elected politicians, they like winning elections, but non-democratic dictators, they also don't want to be overthrown. And we know that economic performance plays an important role in regime longevity. The problem arises when people, say citizens, voters, investors, are not perfectly informed about the state of the economy and must rely on these publicly available indicators, such as gross domestic product. And so you can see kind of the vicious circle that arises in a sense, because governments that want to stay in power and that know that the economy matters are the ones that themselves produce the statistics that people use to assess their performance. And so that was the motivation. And then the question that the paper poses is, okay, everyone, both democracies and autocracies, have an incentive to exaggerate growth, but we would expect that the set of political institutions of checks and balances present in a democracy should be able to constrain or to rein in this incentive or this impulse to exaggerate economic growth.
Is that true? Are there incentives to rein that in American democracy, for example?
Well, my intuition would be that in a well-functioning democracy, in a healthy democracy, you have, say, the opposition in the legislature bringing people in and asking questions about the numbers. You have the media scrutinizing the numbers. You have the judiciary potentially investigating or even prosecuting anyone that they suspect has been fiddling with the numbers. You have freedom of information requests. And then when we start looking at increasingly authoritarian regimes, many of these features start becoming less present or, in fact, largely absent.
So what you're basically saying is you're looking for an independent, data-driven, objective means of analyzing whether or not an economy is growing or not, how an economy is performing based on what? What's the methodology you're using independent of the self-reporting data?
So for a while now, more than a decade at least, economists and researchers in other disciplines, we have been very excited and making great use of data available through remote sensing. And so say data that is recorded by satellites from outer space of various types. The data that I use is data on nighttime lights as recorded by satellites from outer space. Previous work has already shown that these nighttime lights data correlates or is associated with both cross-sectional differences in income, that is to say, places that are richer are brighter at night, but it is also associated with economic growth. As countries grow, as economic activity grows, we observe an increase in the amount of light that places emit. And then the punchline of the paper or the research is to say, well, we have these two sources of information on economic activity. On the one hand, we have the GDP figures, which are for the most part self-reported by national governments. On the other hand, we have the nighttime lights that are captured by satellites from outer space and are much less prone to manipulation.
So explain to us, because you're talking to two guys here who love technology but know very little about it. This is more complex, right, than just looking at sort of like the NASA Earth Images at Night series, right? What are you actually looking at to make those inferences and draw those conclusions? What's the data that you're actually using?
So the raw data is very rich but very complex, because you have several satellites orbiting Earth every night several times. And so then you have to think of ways of first cleaning the data, because for instance, it can be picking up things that we don't want it to be picking up, such as say the winter lights in Northern Europe.
Right.
It can also be picking up say gas flares and other types of things that we don't want to be recording. It can also sometimes not be picking up anything simply because it's cloudy, especially in rainforests or in certain types of areas. So there's a cleaning aspect to the work, and then there's an aggregation aspect where we say, okay, let's just average or add up the information coming from these several satellites and kind of start reducing the dimensionality into something that we can use. At the end of the day, the data that is publicly available for anyone to use has at the pixel level, and so imagine a pixel as a 1 square kilometer piece of land in the equator, we have at the pixel year level a number ranging from 0 to 63. where 0 corresponds to no light being detected, 63 corresponds to some type of top coding or the maximum amount that the satellite can record.
So you're talking about these satellites orbiting the Earth. Who owns these satellites? Who launched them? Are they private? Are they government? And how do you get data? Do you have to buy it from companies? How do you get it?
That's a great question. So the data is publicly available. I think that the initial set of satellites were initially put in orbit by the US Air Force. However, from what I have read, if I'm not mistaken, the original purpose of the satellites was something having to do with trying to detect moonlit clouds. So it had kind of this environmental nature science aspect to it. Of course, as a political economist, it's fair to ask the question whether, you know, in the context of say, the Cold War or the end of the Cold War, whether there were some other motivations. But basically, it's the US Air Force that put the satellites in place, and it is now the NOAA, the National Oceanic Atmospheric Agency, that takes the raw data, processes it, cleans it, and makes it available.
It's available to you. I want to go back to something you said earlier, and maybe you can explain this. You said that richer regions tend to have brighter lights at night. Why is that? I mean, I get New York City. There's a rich area and a lot of nightlife, but globally, why would that be the case?
So it's a combination of, say, public lighting and private sources of light. So you can imagine that both as places that are already lit up, as people get richer, they engage in activities that produce light. Also, the government, maybe as places get rich enough, it extends the electricity infrastructure, and so it is the public lighting, the street lights that are being captured. It can also just be investment, but you can also imagine a bit of what us economists would call the extensive margin, which is places that were previously unlit and where people are now migrating and economic activity is taking place. And well, those people at night, they turn on the lights, they turn on the TV, they turn on all of these things, and that increases the amount of light. By the same token, you also have places that used to have activity and that now, as people are moving away from them, as factories are shutting down, they become dimmer. I can give you one example of that. If you look at, say, Venezuela over the last 4 or 6 years, if you look at how bright it was in 2010 or 2012 and how bright it is today, it has dimmed substantially. And online, there are maps available that have illustrated this, say, relative to Colombia or other neighboring countries.
So I'm curious, is there a, there has to be some, this is not, witchcraft, right? There's academic research, scientific research that goes into establish these correlations between the emission of light and economic activity. So when you look at, for example, like North Korea, which is notoriously dark at night, how are you able to draw conclusions? How do you know that? I think one of your conclusions is that authoritarian governments overstate their GDP by 15% to 30%. Mm-hmm. How do you get to that number?
So I can answer your question in two parts. The first one, maybe it will all become just one big answer. About North Korea, it is true, and there are these striking images where if you look at the area of the two Koreas and you can see the border, you can pretty much clearly establish where the border is, because to the south, you have lots of lights. It looks almost like veins spreading in all directions. And to the north, it's pretty much all dark, except for maybe a tiny spot in Pyongyang. And part of my methodology is to say, sure, nighttime lights are a proxy for economic activity. They're not a perfect measure, in the same way that GDP is also a proxy for economic activity. It's not a perfect measure. Part of the idea underlying my work is to say, fair enough, North Korea is very dark, but it would be very suspicious if all of a sudden North Korea started claiming that their economy is growing, that its economy is growing at high rates, and we didn't observe the other side of that, which is that the country is becoming brighter at night.
We need to take a quick moment for station identification. This is Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. 4 times every weekend, you can find us on Sirius XM Satellite Radio's popular Politics of the United States. That's the POTUS channel, number 124. We produce this program with a talented team of professionals at Rhode Island PBS, and we're lucky to work with them. I'm Jim Lutis. In my day job, I run the Pell Center for International Relations and Public Policy at Salve Regina University in historic Newport, Rhode Island. If you want to connect with me on Twitter, I'm at JM Lutis. Joining me, as always, is my friend and co-host G. Wayne Miller, who is the author of 17 books and an award-winning journalist with the Providence Journal. You can connect with Wayne on Twitter, too, at G. Wayne Miller, all one word. And our guest this week is an assistant professor at the Harris School of Public Policy at the University of Chicago, whose scholarship focuses on political economy, especially in Latin America. He's Luis R. Martinez, and he's on Twitter, too, at Luis R. Martinez. That's at Luis R. Martinez A. Luis R. Martinez, the letter A.
Wouldn't it be possible, though, in the case of North Korea, that the regime there would simply tell its citizens to keep the lights off? I mean, they have that level of control, whether as a social means of control, keep people inside in their homes, or in other words, could there be sort of an aspect there where economic growth could be occurring but not being reflected, pardon the pun, in terms of nighttime light?
So a silly answer to that would be, someone told me the other day that after this research that I've been doing, dictators are going to start doing the opposite, which is, I don't know, buy some big spotlights and put them towards outer space.
Well, that would be an acknowledgement of the value of your work.
But
you can only hope, right?
I would be honored. But a more serious answer is that your comment does indicate the type of problem that this type of research runs into, because I am comparing, again, what the nightlights are saying about economic activity to what GDP is saying, where the idea is, if there's no manipulation, the relationship between these two variables should be roughly the same, whether we're looking at a democracy or whether we're looking at an autocracy. Now, I say that the endeavor runs into trouble because, of course, countries that are democratic differ in many other ways from countries that are not. So they may differ, for instance, in their economic structure, say in their dependence on agriculture or natural resources. So I could reframe your comment as saying, well, one concern could be that, say, authoritarian regimes engage in types of economic activity that are not captured by nighttime lights in the same way as GDP does, and that any type of asymmetry, any suspicious pattern, is arising because of the type of economic activity rather than from manipulation.
So I have to ask, how did you get to this methodology? So I think about political economists, you know, there's a wide breadth of sort of areas of focus and expertise, but you're using sort of a novel approach of multispectral analysis from assets in space to draw conclusions that are really compelling about the economic performance of isolated countries around the world. How did you get here? What drew you to this particular tool?
So on the one hand, as you mentioned a moment ago, I am relying on a large amount of previous research that has documented that nighttime lights are useful as a measure of economic activity in various settings, at various scales. So we can look at countries, we can look at cities, we can look at very tightly defined cells or pixels, and still the nighttime lights appear to capture what's going on the ground. At the same time, I've always enjoyed this relatively new branch of economics called forensic economics, which involves this idea of using data and statistical methods to try to uncover behavior that, say, people would like to keep hidden. Yeah. So in some of my previous work, for instance, 10 years ago or so, there was this big controversy between Colombia and Venezuela, where the Colombian government would argue that the left-wing insurgents of the FARC and the ELN, that they were hiding inside of Venezuela. And the Venezuelan government would say, no, they're not. And as I would watch this going on the news, I would ask myself, well, would there be a way to use data to try to see who's right here? And so in some of my previous work, I used data on the geography of conflict inside Colombia, and I show that areas closer to the border with Venezuela have a dramatic increase in the amount of insurgent activity after Hugo Chavez becomes president, consistent with him providing them increased access to Venezuela, which allows them to carry out activities on the other side. So, So in my work, there's been for a while this idea of how can we use data in a novel, in an innovative way to try to uncover these types of behavior.
Now, I've never heard the term forensic economics, and it's a fascinating term. You gave a bit of a definition there. Can you talk a little bit more about what that is, why it's emerging, and as a field or as a sub-genre, as it were, of economics?
So I would say that economics is definitely not what it was 20 or 30 or 40 years ago. In that regard, I work at the University of Chicago, and someone like, say, Gary Becker was a pivotal figure in showing the extent to which the tools of economics can be used to understand phenomena taking place in other realms that are not what traditionally economics was supposed to be about. And then more recently, you know, you have work by researchers in various places that has moved in that direction. So for instance, we have research that looks at, say, missing imports, where a country reports that they are exporting things, but then when you look on the other side, you realize that the goods are being reclassified in a way that minimizes the tariffs that have to be paid. Recent work, for instance, also showed, this one I like quite a bit, about ski resorts, I believe it was here in the US, and the amount of snow that they report. And so that one was very similar in spirit to what I'm doing, because it was all about, well, the ski resort posts how much snow there is,
yeah.
But then you also have from another source the real amount of snow.
Which was less than what they were posting.
Of course, because they want to attract the customers. And,
Wow, who knew?
What's the policy upshot? So if you're a policymaker and you're sort of getting, you know, we have this body of academic research that says that authoritarian regimes are overstating their GDP by 15 to 30%. Are there policy implications that come with this?
I would say that there are, to some extent, even if all that we can accomplish is to raise a red flag and say there's something worth looking into in more detail here, that would already be an accomplishment. But there are some, I do look at some policy tools worth thinking about. I can give you one example. The data that is publicly available, the GDP data that is publicly available, say in the World Bank's research, it gets revised frequently. So you can look at what the data looked like for the same period of time in, say, 2006, but then what that data looks like in 2010. And there, so you can imagine this process where I would imagine World Bank officials talk to national statistical officers and say, where did this number come from? This doesn't make sense. When I look at those data revisions, I do not find a lot in terms of attenuation of this pattern of excess reporting of GDP in autocracies. So that doesn't seem
to
work.
So the lies don't get better, is what you're saying.
Or they do not get washed out, because you could also think that the autocrats, they exaggerate in the short run, and they know that no one's going to pay attention to the GDP figures from 5 or 10 years ago.
Okay.
So you put up a fight at first, and after a while you say, right, let's... An initiative that I do look at and that seems to be successful is the IMF has a set of guidelines for member countries that want to access...
The International Monetary Fund.
The International Monetary Fund has a set of guidelines for member countries that want to access financial markets. Almost the idea being, well, if you want us to give you the stamp of approval and to say that you're a country worthy of participating in financial markets, these are the rules that you should meet. And these rules concern the type of information that should be made available, the frequency with which it should be made available, how it is constructed, and so on. And when I look at the set of countries that belong to this agreement, the pattern that I observe, where the amount of growth in lights maps onto larger amounts of GDP growth in autocracies, is not present, which indicates that this type of initiative is successful at allowing us to distinguish between the countries that engage in this type of practice and those that do not.
That's fascinating.
It is fascinating. I want to go back to the satellite-based technology, for lack of a better word. And what do you find in terms of Russia? Now, I think Vladimir Putin, the president of Russia, would say one thing about the Russian economy, and I think people in the West might say another thing. Have you studied Russia using the satellite dark or lights at night technology, and what do you conclude?
So I can tell you this, which is that I try not to zoom in too much to particular countries, because I feel that to some extent the value of the exercise comes from the availability of a large amount of data So I prefer to keep the comparison at different regime types where we get to observe various countries in each category or a same country switching across categories. Having said that, I carry out various types of disaggregate analysis. One that I do indicates that countries that have had a communist regime at some point in time do appear to engage in exaggeration of GDP figures to a larger extent. Now, to me, this is consistent with bits and pieces of evidence that are available out there that go back to, say, Stalinist Russia, where you observe that, for instance, the famous case of the population census of 1937, where the numbers come in, Stalin doesn't like them. He actually arrests and have the statistical officers executed. He brings in a new team that produces numbers more to his liking. And the manipulation of information that takes place in Stalinist Russia or even more recently in communist China, there's evidence that indicates that this is going on. And so if you ask me about Russia, one thing that I can definitely tell you is that there is this legacy from the communist regime and its almost proven willingness to engage in manipulation of information, which is likely to permeate into what happens today.
Do you have any advice for just American citizens or anybody around the world, just the average citizen who's not a policymaker? What should we take away from this research in terms of our thinking about the kind of data that we're receiving from government sources?
Well, my work does raise the issue that we tend to believe what the government tells us. So in this world of say fake news, and now hopefully we pay more attention to the source of information, and when it's some obscure website that we've never heard of, we probably tend to dismiss that information to some extent. But when something comes from an official source, we tend to have it in a bit of higher regard. So on the one hand, as consumers of information, there's definitely some type of warning sign in my work saying the fact that information comes from governments should not take us to just interpret it as absolutely true and not worthy of further analysis. On the other hand, I would say that my work does illustrate the importance of democracy understood as a set of political institutions and especially a set of checks and balances. And so my work does illustrate that these democratic institutions do play a fundamental role in constraining the type of activities that governments engage in.
It's a fascinating conversation. Luis Martinez, thank you so much for being with us. He's Luis Martinez from the University of Chicago. That is all the time we have this week. But if you want to know more about Storing the Public Square, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter or visit pellcenter.org. He's Wayne, I'm Jim. We hope you'll join us next time for more Story in the Public Square.